with for years. He was now tired of her and was searching for a pretext to get rid of her. But as he had eaten up the dowry which she had originally brought with her, he was puzzled as to how to disembarrass himself of her without making restitution. The simplest thing was to so antagonize her that she would choose starvation rather than support his cruelties. She was rather a fine person, his mistress. The worst that one could say against her was that she had lost her shape and her ability to support him any longer. She was a painter herself, and among those who professed to know, it was said that she had far more talent than he. But no matter how miserable he made life for her, she was just. She would never allow anyone to say that he was not a great painter. It was because he really has genius, she said, that he was such a rotten individual. One never saw her canvases on the wall, only his. Her things were stuck away in the kitchen. Once it happened in my presence that someone insisted on seeing her work. The result was painful. You see this figure? Said Swift, pointing to one of her canvases with his big foot. The man standing in the doorway there is just about to go out for a leak. He won't be able to find his way back because his head is on wrong. Now take that nude over there. It was all right until she started to paint the cunt. I don't know what she was thinking about, but she made it so big that her brush slipped, and she couldn't get it out again. By way of showing us what a nude ought to be like, he hauls out a huge canvas which he had recently completed. It was a picture of her, a splendid piece of vengeance inspired by a guilty conscience, the work of a madman, vicious, petty, malign, brilliant. You had the feeling that he had spied on her through the keyhole, that he had caught her in an off moment when she was picking her nose absent-mindedly or scratching her ass. She sat there on the horsehair sofa, in a room without ventilation, an enormous room without a window. It might as well have been the anterior lobe of the pineal gland. Back of her ran the zigzag stairs leading to the balcony. They were covered with a bilious green carpet, such a green as could only emanate from a universe that had been pooped out. The most prominent thing was her buttocks, which were lopsided and full of scabs. She seemed to have slightly raised her ass from the sofa, as if to let a loud fart. Her face he had idealized. It looked sweet and virginal, pure as a cough drop. But her bosom was distended, swollen with sewer gas. She seemed to be swimming in a menstrual sea, an enlarged fetus with the dull, syrupy look of an angel. Nevertheless, one couldn't help but like him. He was an indefatigable worker, a man who hadn't a single thought in his head but paint, and cunning as a lynx withal. It was he who put it into my head to cultivate the friendship of Fillmore, a young man in the diplomatic service who had found his way into the little group that surrounded Kruger and Swift. Let him help you, he said. He doesn't know what to do with his money. When one spends what he has on himself, when one has a thoroughly good time with his own money, people are apt to say, he doesn't know what to do with his money. For my part, I don't see any better use to which one can put money. About such individuals, one can't say that they're generous or stingy. They put money into circulation. That's the principal thing. Fillmore knew that his days in France were limited. He was determined to enjoy them. And as one always enjoys himself better in the company of a friend, it was only natural that he should turn to one like myself, who had plenty of time on his hands, for that companionship which he needed. People said he was a bore, and so he was, I suppose, but when you're in need of food, you can put up with worse things than being bored. After all, despite the fact that he talked incessantly, and usually about himself or the authors whom he admired slavishly, such birds as Anatole France and Joseph Conrad, he nevertheless made my nights interesting in other ways. He liked to dance, he liked good wines, and he liked women. That he liked Byron also, and Victor Hugo, one could forgive. He was only a few years out of college, and he had plenty of time ahead of him to be cured of such tastes. What he had that I liked was a sense of adventure. We got even better acquainted, more intimate, I might say, due to a peculiar incident that occurred during my brief sojourn with Kruger. It happened just after the arrival of Collins, a sailor whom Fillmore had got to know on the way over from America. The three of us used to meet regularly on the terrace of the Rotonde before going to dinner. It was always Pernod, a drink which put Collins in good humor and provided a base, as it were, for the wine and beer and phen, etc., which had to be guzzled afterward. All during Collins's stay in Paris, I lived like a duke. Nothing but fowl and good vintages and desserts that I hadn't even heard of before. A month of this regimen, and I should have been obliged to go to Baden-Baden, or Vichy, or Aix-les-Bains. Meanwhile, Kruger was putting me up at his studio. I was getting to be a nuisance because I never showed up before 3 a.m., and it was difficult to rout me out of bed before noon. Overtly, Kruger never uttered a word of reproach, but his manner indicated plainly enough that I was becoming a bum. One day I was taken ill. The rich diet was taking effect upon me. I don't know what ailed me, but I couldn't get out of bed. I had lost all my stamina, and with it whatever courage I possessed. Kruger had to look after me, had to make broths for me, and so on. It was a trying period for him, more particularly because he was just on the verge of giving an important exhibition at his studio, a private showing to some wealthy connoisseurs from whom he was expecting aid. The cot on which I lay was in the studio. There was no other room to put me in. The morning of the day he was to give his exhibition, Kruger awoke thoroughly disgruntled. If I had been able to stand on my feet, I know he would have given me a clout in the jaw and kicked me out. But I was prostrate and weak as a cat. He tried to coax me out of bed, with the idea of locking me up in the kitchen upon the arrival of his visitors. I realized that I was making a mess of it for him. People can't look at pictures and statues with enthusiasm when a man is dying before their eyes. Kruger honestly thought I was dying. So did I. That's why, despite my feelings of guilt, I couldn't muster any enthusiasm when he proposed calling for the ambulance and having me shipped to the American hospital. I wanted to die there, comfortably, right in the studio. I didn't want to be urged to get up and find a better place to die in. I didn't care where I died, really, so long as it wasn't necessary to get up. When he heard me talk this way, Kruger became alarmed. Worse than having a sick man in his studio should the visitors arrive was to have a dead man. That would completely ruin his prospects, slim as they were. He didn't put it that way to me, of course, but I could see from his agitation that that was what worried him. And that made me stubborn. I refused to let him call the hospital. I refused to let him call a doctor. I refused everything. He got so angry with me finally that, despite my protestations, he began to dress me. I was too weak to resist. All I could do was to murmur weakly, "You bastard, you." Though it was warm outdoors, I was shivering like a dog. After he had completely dressed me, he flung an overcoat over me and slipped outside to telephone. "I won't go. I won't go," I kept saying, but he simply slammed the door on me. He came back in a few minutes and, without addressing a word to me, busied himself about the studio, last-minute preparations. In a little while, there was a knock on the door. It was Fillmore. Collins was waiting downstairs, he informed me. The two of them, Fillmore and Kruger, slipped their arms under me and hoisted me to my feet. As they dragged me to the elevator, Kruger softened up. "It's for your own good," he said. "And besides, it wouldn't be fair to me. You know what a struggle I've had all these years. You ought to think about me, too." He was actually on the point of tears. Wretched and miserable as I felt, his words almost made me smile. He was considerably older than I, and even though he was a rotten painter, a rotten artist all the way through, he deserved a break, at least once in a lifetime. "I don't hold it against you," I muttered. "I understand how it is." "You know I always liked you," he responded. "When you get better, you can come back here again. You can stay as long as you like." "Sure, I know. I'm not going to croak yet," I managed to get out. Somehow, when I saw Collins down below, my spirits revived. If ever anyone seemed to be thoroughly alive, healthy, joyous, magnanimous, it was he. He picked me up as if I were a doll and laid me out on the seat of the cab, gently too, which I appreciated after the way Kruger had manhandled me. When we drove up to the hotel that Collins was stopping at, there was a bit of a discussion with the proprietor, during which I lay stretched out on the sofa in the bureau. I could hear Collins saying to the patron that it was nothing, just a little breakdown, be all right in a few days. I saw him put a crisp bill in the man's hands, and then, turning swiftly and lithely, he came back to where I was and said, "Come on, buck up. Don't let him think you're croaking." And with that, he yanked me to my feet, and bracing me with one arm, escorted me to the elevator. Don't let him think you're croaking. Obviously, it was bad taste to die on people's hands. One should die in the bosom of his family, in private, as it were. His words were encouraging. I began to see it all as a bad joke. Upstairs, with the door closed, they undressed me and put me between the sheets. You can't die now, goddammit, said Collins warmly. You'll put me in a hole. Besides, what the hell's the matter with you? Can't stand good living? Keep your chin up. You'll be eating a porterhouse steak in a day or two. You think you're ill? Wait, by Jesus, until you get a dose of syphilis. That's something to make you worry. And he began to relate, in a humorous way, his trip down the Yangtze Kiang, with hair falling out and teeth rotting away. In the feeble state that I was in, the yarn that he spun had an extraordinary soothing effect upon me. It took me completely out of myself. He had guts, this guy. Perhaps he put it on a bit thick for my benefit, but I wasn't listening to him critically at the moment. I was all ears and eyes. I saw the dirty yellow mouth of the river, the lights going up at Hankow, the sea of yellow faces, the sampans shooting down through the gorges, and the rapids flaming with the sulphurous breath of the dragon. What a story! The coolies swarming around the boat each day, dredging for the garbage that was flung overboard, Tom Slattery rising up on his deathbed to take a last look at the lights of Hankow, the beautiful Eurasian who lay in a dark room and filled his veins with poison, the monotony of blue jackets and yellow faces, millions and millions of them hollowed out by famine, ravaged by disease, subsisting on rats and dogs and roots, chewing the grass off the earth, devouring their own children. It was hard to imagine that this man's body had once been a mass of sores, that he had been shunned like a leper. His voice was so quiet and gentle. It was as though his spirit had been cleansed by all the suffering he had endured. As he reached for his drink, his face grew more and more soft, and his words actually seemed to caress me. And all the while, China hanging over us like fate itself. A China rotting away, crumbling to dust like a huge dinosaur, yet preserving to the very end the glamour, the enchantment, the mystery, the cruelty of her hoary legends. I could no longer follow his story. My mind had slipped back to a 4th of July when I bought my first package of firecrackers, and with it the long pieces of punk which break so easily, the punk that you blow on to get a good red glow, the punk whose smell sticks to your fingers for days and makes you dream of strange things. The 4th of July, the streets are littered with bright red paper, stamped with black and gold figures, and everywhere there are tiny firecrackers which have the most curious intestines. Packages and packages of them, all strung together by their thin, flat little gut strings, the color of human brains. All day long there is the smell of powder and punk, and the gold dust from the bright red wrappers sticks to your fingers. One never thinks of China, but it is there all the time, on the tips of your fingers, and it makes your nose itchy. And long afterward, when you have forgotten almost what a firecracker smells like, you wake up one day with gold leaf choking you, and the broken pieces of punk waft back their pungent odor, and the bright red wrappers give you a nostalgia for a people and a soil you have never known, but which is in your blood, mysteriously there in your blood, like the sense of time or space, a fugitive, constant value to which you turn more and more as you get old, which you try to seize with your mind, but ineffectually. Because in everything Chinese there is wisdom and mystery, and you can never grasp it with two hands or with your mind, but you must let it rub off, let it stick to your fingers, let it slowly infiltrate your veins. A few weeks later, upon receipt of a pressing invitation from Collins, who had returned to Le Havre, Fillmore and I boarded the train one morning, prepared to spend the weekend with him. It was the first time I had been outside of Paris since my arrival here. We were in fine fettle, drinking Anjou all the way to the coast. Collins had given us the address of a bar where we were to meet. It was a place called Jimmy's Bar, which everyone in Le Havre was supposed to know. We got into an open barouche at the station and started on a brisk trot for the rendezvous. There was still a half bottle of Anjou left, which we polished off as we rode along. Le Havre looked gay, sunny. The air was bracing, with that strong, salty tang which almost made me homesick for New York. There were masts and hulls cropping up everywhere, bright bits of bunting, big open squares and high-ceilinged cafes, such as one only sees in the provinces. A fine impression immediately. The city was welcoming us with open arms. Before we ever reached the bar, we saw Collins coming down the street on a trot, heading for the station, no doubt, and a little late, as usual. Fillmore immediately suggested a Pernod. We were all slapping each other on the back, laughing and spitting, drunk already from the sunshine and the salt sea air. Collins seemed undecided about the Pernod at first. He had a little dose of clap, he informed us. Nothing very serious, a strain, most likely. He showed us a bottle he had in his pocket. Venetienne, it was called, if I remember rightly. The sailor's remedy for clap. We stopped off at a restaurant to have a little snack before repairing to Jimmy's place. It was a huge tavern with big, smoky rafters and tables creaking with food. We drank copiously of the wines that Collins recommended. Then we sat down on a terrasse and had coffee and liqueurs. Collins was talking about the Baron de Charlus, a man after his own heart, he said. For almost a year now he had been staying at Le Havre, going through the money that he had accumulated during his bootlegging days. His tastes were simple: food, drink, women, and books, and a private bath. That he insisted on. We were still talking about the Baron de Charlus when we arrived at Jimmy's bar. It was late in the afternoon, and the place was just beginning to fill up. Jimmy was there, his face red as a beet, and beside him was his spouse, a fine, buxom Frenchwoman with glittering eyes. We were given a marvelous reception all around. There were Pernod in front of us again, the gramophone was shrieking, people were jabbering away in English and French and Dutch and Norwegian and Spanish, and Jimmy and his wife, both of them looking very brisk and dapper, were slapping and kissing each other heartily and raising their glasses and clinking them. Altogether such a bubble and blabber of merriment that you felt like pulling off your clothes and doing a war dance. The women at the bar had gathered around like flies. If we were friends of Collins, that meant we were rich. It didn't matter that we had come in our old clothes, all Anglais dress like that. I hadn't a sou in my pocket, which didn't matter, of course, since I was the guest of honor. Nevertheless, I felt somewhat embarrassed with two stunning-looking whores hanging on my arms, waiting for me to order something. I decided to take the bull by the horns. You couldn't tell anymore which drinks were on the house and which were to be paid for. I had to be a gentleman, even if I didn't have a sou in my pocket. Yvette, that was Jimmy's wife, was extraordinarily gracious and friendly with us. She was preparing a little spread in our honor. It would take a little while yet. We were not to get too drunk. She wanted us to enjoy the meal. The gramophone was going like wild, and Fillmore had begun to dance with a beautiful mulatto who had on a tight velvet dress that revealed all her charms. Collins slipped over to my side and whispered a few words about the girl at my side. "The Madame will invite her to dinner," he said, "if you'd like to have her." She was an ex-whore who owned a beautiful home on the outskirts of the city, the mistress of a sea captain now. He was away, and there was nothing to fear. "If she likes you, she'll invite you to stay with her," he added. That was enough for me. I turned at once to Marcel and began to flatter the ass off her. We stood at the corner of the bar, pretending to dance, and mauled each other ferociously. Jimmy gave me a big horse wink and nodded his head approvingly. She was a lascivious bitch, this Marcel, and pleasant at the same time. She soon got rid of the other girl, I noticed, and then we settled down for a long and intimate conversation, which was interrupted, unfortunately, by the announcement that dinner was ready. There were about 20 of us at the table, and Marcel and I were placed at one end opposite Jimmy and his wife. It began with the popping of champagne corks and was quickly followed by drunken speeches, during the course of which Marcel and I played with each other under the table. When it came my turn to stand up and deliver a few words, I had to hold the napkin in front of me. It was painful and exhilarating at the same time. I had to cut the speech very short because Marcel was tickling me in the crotch all the while. The dinner lasted until almost midnight. I was looking forward to spending the night with Marcel in that beautiful home up on the cliff, but it was not to be. Collins had planned to show us about, and I couldn't very well refuse. "Don't worry about her," he said. "You'll have a bellyful of it before you leave. Tell her to wait here for you until we get back." She was a bit peeved at this, Marcel, but when we informed her that we had several days ahead of us, she brightened up. When we got outdoors, Fillmore very solemnly took us by the arm and said he had a little confession to make. He looked pale and worried.
"Well, what is it?"
said Collins cheerfully.